So this episode is going to contain descriptions of violence. I deliberately wrote this episode so that it would not contain much information besides the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day itself. So if you would rather skip this episode, it shouldn't interfere with your enjoyment of the narrative overall. Just a warning for viewer discretion. As always, if you enjoy the show, please rate it on the podcast app of your choice. Support me on Patreon, or tell the history lover in your life about the show. I don't know if I've made this clear, but it's genuinely just me in my small apartment doing this, so any support is very much appreciated. You can also go to MediciPodcast.com for maps, bibliographies, and more. On the night of August 23rd, just before St. Bartholomew's Day, Admiral Coligny was still in bed recuperating from being shot. His supporters and the other Huguenot leaders knew very well they were vulnerable. However, Coligny was still too weak to safely travel, and they could not bring themselves to abandon the man who had become widely seen as the Moses of their movement, destined to free the Huguenots from the tyranny and persecution they suffered under the Catholic Pharaoh. Besides, as frosty as Coligny's relationship with King Charles IX had become, perhaps Coligny thought his ties to the king were enough to keep him and his fellow Huguenots safe. But at the same time, Admiral Coligny may have reflected on the last words he spoke to Charles IX before the attempt on his own life. Frustrated that Charles kept putting off meeting with him about a prospective military campaign into the Netherlands to support the Dutch rebels against the Spanish crown, Coligny lost his temper and not only threatened to leave Paris, but warned that the king might face another civil war instead of a foreign one. That same night, Marguerite was having an unhappy night there in the royal palace of the Louvre. She didn't much care for her new husband, Henri de Bourbon, nor apparently did he really like her in spite of her famous beauty. They hadn't even consummated their marriage. It didn't help that the Huguenots who surrounded her husband didn't trust her, nor did her own family, apparently. As Marguerite observed in her memoirs, "The Huguenots suspected me because I was a Catholic, and the Catholics because I had married the King of Navarre." Like a good daughter, before she retired to bed, she went to her mother's chambers to say good night. According to Marguerite's own account, her sister Claude was there as well and tearfully pleaded with her to spend the night with them instead. Catherine angrily told Claude to be quiet, impatiently assuring Claude that God would protect her sister from any harm. "Marguerite," Catherine continued, "had to return to Henri, or they would become suspicious." When Marguerite hesitated, Catherine angrily ordered her to go to bed. Unnerved, Marguerite left the room. Unnerved, Marguerite did so. She did not find any comfort from her husband, who spent the night talking to his friends in the other room. Marguerite could do nothing but pray in private. After that, she slept fitfully for the rest of the night. At about 3 a.m., Coligny was woken up by the sound of rough voices and shouting. His companions warned him that the Duke of Guise and his men had just stormed into the building. They wanted to stay and try to protect him or help him escape, even though Coligny could barely stand up on his own legs. Coligny urged them to leave while they still could, saying, "For a long time now I have been preparing for death. Save yourself. for you cannot save me. One of Coligny's men had tried barricading the door with a chest of drawers, but Guise's men kicked in the door. A Bohemian mercenary approached Coligny and asked him if he was the admiral. He said, "I am. I should at least be killed by a gentleman and not this boor," proving that class doesn't have a place when it comes to violence. The mercenary ran him through with a pike, killing him instantly. His corpse was thrown out the window. The Duke of Guise inspected the admiral's body and kicked it before leaving. This was only the beginning. The word had gone out. The Duke of Guise's men and many of the king's own guards, mercenaries, and soldiers went around the Louvre, where most of the Huguenot leaders were staying, stabbing them or slitting their throats in their beds. Oblivious to the horrors happening to his friends, Henri de Bourbon left his chambers at dawn to play tennis with his cousin, the Prince of Condé. As they walked down the corridor, they were stopped by some guards who told them nothing except that they needed to be detained for their own protection. The guards proceeded to lock them up in a chamber of the palace. Later on, according to one account, Henri de Bourbon and the Prince of Condé were brought to the royal apartments, where King Charles ranted and berated them, saying they had a simple choice, death or the mass. Henri folded right away. The Prince of Condé put up some token resistance before he, too, converted to Catholicism. Henri de Bourbon was forced practically at sword point to write a letter to the Pope asking for his forgiveness for his heresy and sign an edict re-establishing Catholicism in his domains. At one point, when Henri knelt with the royal court before an altar in a typically Catholic gesture, Catherine de Medici turned to some foreign dignitaries that were present and laughed. We don't know what was going through Henri's head at the time he was a captive at the French royal court. Whether it was fear and trauma or just a concern for his own survival, it did not stop Henri, during the days after the massacre, from playing tennis with the Duke of Guise, the man responsible for the murders of many of his supporters and friends. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Back to the fateful morning of August 24th, Marguerite was woken up by one of Henri's attendants, who had been badly wounded. In her memoirs, she would write, "I jumped out of bed and the poor gentleman after me, holding me fast by the waist. I did not then know him, neither was I sure that he came to do me no harm, or whether the archers were in pursuit of him or me. In this situation, I screamed aloud, and he cried out likewise, for our fright was mutual." The captain of the guard barged in and laughed at Marguerite's fear, but he also barked at the men, scolding them for barging into the chambers of a member of the royal family. Marguerite bravely talked the captain of the guard out of letting the attendant be killed. Not only that, she had the man's wounds dressed and let him recuperate in her bed. The captain offered to escort Marguerite to the apartments that her sister Claude were staying in, which were presumably in a different part of the palace from where most of the Huguenots were located. On the way there, Marguerite wrote, "As we passed through the antechamber, all the doors of which were wide open, a gentleman of the name of Bourse, pursued by archers, was run through the body with a pike and fell dead at my feet. As if I had been killed by the same stroke, I fell." As she fainted, Marguerite was caught by the captain, who brought her safely to her sister's rooms. Outside the Louvre, it was, quite simply, hell on earth. Early on in the morning, acting on the rumor that the king himself had ordered the good Catholics of Paris to slay every Huguenot they could get their hands on, people either barricaded themselves in their homes or armed themselves and went out on the attack. King Charles sent out a proclamation that all people in Paris were to return to their homes, and the Duke of Anjou had been sent out with a squadron of soldiers to restore order. But once it was clear to them what was happening, most of the soldiers under his command joined the crowds of killers and looters. In the Cemetery of Innocents, the sudden blossoming of a hawthorn bush, the same plant the crown of Christ was made from, according to legend, was taken as a miraculous sign that God had approved of the killing of Coligny and whatever else was necessary to deal with the Protestants. Even in death, Coligny was further victimized by the furious people of Paris. His head, hands, and genitals were cut off. His remains were then dragged through the streets, set on fire in the same way as a heretic would be executed, and the ashes thrown into the River Seine. An observer named Claude Hatton found that the crowd that mutilated and burned Coligny's body had arranged a mock trial, just as if they were judges and officers of the court. Coligny's head was taken to the Louvre and shown to Catherine and the king. Then it was mummified and sent as a trophy to the Pope in Rome. It is important to know that most of the people killed were not prominent Huguenots like Coligny, but everyday people, and the ones who killed them were also usually everyday people. The stories of the atrocities that were gleefully carried out on St. Bartholomew's Day and the following days were numerous, and no doubt there were exaggerations, but history, and sadly even recent experience, teach us such horrors are far from impossible. People stormed into the houses of their Huguenot neighbors and killed everyone inside. Badly wounded people who were still alive and begging for help were dumped into the River Seine. Corpses were left in the street or dumped into mass graves. There's even a report of a group of young children dragging a baby behind them on a rope through the streets. Members of Catherine's own flying squadron watched the massacre with amusement and curiosity, and one mercenary participating in the slaughter obliged them by bringing a freshly killed corpse close enough for their inspection. It was also said that King Charles watched the violence unfold from a balcony in the Louvre. When he saw a man stabbed beneath the balcony, he allegedly exclaimed, "If only he were the last of the Huguenots." But not everyone at the royal court was driven by morbid curiosity or hate. Charles's pious, neglected Queen Elizabeth of Austria spent hours praying that God forgive her husband for all the deaths he caused. We also know many of the victims' names. A girl from a Huguenot family named Agnes was baptized into Catholicism in her parents' own blood, and her parents' killers made her swear she would not revert back to heresy, or they would somehow find out and kill her too. An artisan named Bertrand was slain on the streets along with all of his apprentices and employees. Mathurin Lussault was killed instantly when he answered his door. When his son came downstairs to investigate the commotion, he was stabbed and left to die on the street. Lussault's wife, Francoise, tried to escape from an upstairs window by leaping into her next-door neighbor's courtyard. Breaking both legs in her fall, she was soon discovered despite her neighbor's attempts to hide her. She was impaled on a spit, and after being marched around the streets of Paris, her corpse was thrown into the River Seine, along with so many others. A bookshop owner named Jacques Curver happily betrayed his Huguenot son-in-law to the mob. But Catholics did not just kill Huguenots, but each other. The massacre was a perfect opportunity to settle grudges, get rid of unwanted relatives, spouses, and neighbors, and neatly resolve debts and legal disputes. But aside from the countless opportunistic killers, there are many more who are motivated by pure hatred and fear of the Protestant minority. Historian Mac Holt explains the ritualistic violence and cruelty unleashed on Huguenots like Agnes this way. Viewed by Catholics as threats to the social and political order, Huguenots not only had to be exterminated, that is, killed, they also had to be humiliated, dishonored, and shamed as the inhuman beasts they were perceived to be. The victims had to be dehumanized, slaughtered like animals, since they had violated all the sacred laws of humanity and Catholic culture. In the end, historians tend to agree that at least 2,000 people in Paris were killed. Despite Charles's orders that the magistrates in the provinces preserve order, violence spread to other French cities, leading to further massacres, in which another 3,000 people are thought to have been killed. despite his earlier command urging an end to the violence. On August 26, while killing still continued in parts of Paris, Charles IX spoke to the Parliament of Paris and claimed that Coligny and the Huguenots had plotted against him. As Charles explained in a proclamation soon published across the kingdom, His Majesty declares that all that occurred was by his express commandment, and not for any religious reasons, nor in contravention of his edicts of pacification, which he has always intended and still wishes and intends to observe, keep, and undertake, but rather to ward off and prevent the execution of an unfortunate and detestable conspiracy by the Admiral, its head and author, and his adherents and accomplices against the person of the King and his state, the Queen his mother, his brothers, the King of Navarre, and other princes and lords close to them. Nonetheless, the Pope and the King of Spain believed the massacre had been planned. The Spanish ambassador to France, Diego de Zuniga, wrote chillingly to King Philip, As I write, they are killing them all. They are stripping them and dragging them through the streets. They are pillaging the houses and not leaving a single child. Let us bless God for having converted the French princes to his cause. May he inspire their hearts to go on as it began. King Philip was said to have burst out laughing with joy when he read the letter. Pope Gregory XIII called for a special hymn, the Te Deum, and called for a celebration. He also commissioned a plaque that showed an angel carrying a cross, looking over approvingly at the murder of Coligny and the other Huguenot leaders. The Pope also gladly declared Catherine the conservator of Christianity. Philip II praised her too. He praised the son for having such a mother, then the mother for having such a son. Pleased by the positive attention from her once implacable critics, Catherine asked a Spanish envoy, Am I as bad a Christian as the Duke of Alba used to claim? Even in the wake of such a great, religiously motivated slaughter, Catherine still proved herself the master of real politique. While Catherine was happy to let the Pope and the King of Spain believe she was the architect of the program, at the exact same time, she communicated to the German Protestant princes and Queen Elizabeth of England that she had been merely acting to smash a conspiracy against the king, and things had badly gotten out of hand. And the latter excuse was actually close to the truth. Catherine and Charles were apparently actually convinced that there was going to be a Huguenot plot. But it certainly didn't help their reputation or their Protestant subjects' faith in them that Catherine and Charles had to put out very different narratives about what happened to both appease Spain and try to ensure that they would have Protestant allies in case Spain ever turned on them. Catherine was definitely, even in this moment, never a Catholic hardliner like Philip of Spain. And there is no reason to believe, based on the evidence we have, that she wanted the bloodshed to go further than the Huguenot leadership. That said, there's also no clear evidence that she ever personally regretted what happened. Indeed, she may very well have had lost all sympathy for the Huguenots who had caused her so much grief over the years. I can't help but wonder if something about the Huguenots, who righteously looked down upon the supposed decadence of the royal court, that made Catherine think of the fanatical Savonarolans who menaced her when she was only a child. 21 or so years after the massacre, the English playwright Christopher Marlowe would write a play about the events of St. Bartholomew's Day. He portrays Catherine as a traditional female archvillain, in the same vein as Empress Livia or Queen Fredegund, willing to poison her own sons to make sure she stayed in power. Tush, all shall die unless I have my will, she says in the play, musing over the possibility she'd have to kill her own beloved son, the Duke of Anjou. This is the black legend of Catherine de' Medici, the occultist, the poisoner, and the mass murderer. By instigating the massacre, even unwittingly, Catherine ensured that she would not be remembered even in France as a peacemaker, but as a figure of feminine evil, much like her contemporary Queen Bloody Mary. But even if you put all that aside and look at her actions from the ruthless viewpoint of pure politics, Catherine had made a rare blunder. Rather than killing the French Protestant movement by cutting off its head, she gave the Protestants new resolve and proved that she and her sons could not be trusted. Indeed, for some, she had brought the entire institution of the God-ordained monarchy into question. Thank you for listening, and buona notte.